Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, well, we're going to do something that's not possible because of the pandemic. We're all staying at home and staying within our 5 kilometres, but in our imaginations, we're able to travel the world. So in tonight's show, we're going to travel almost 4,000 kilometres as we go to one of the greatest cities in the world, Istanbul. It's a city on 2 continents and the place where Liverpool Football Club found a miracle in 2005. Yes, we are exploring the history of Istanbul, and we would love you to join our discussion by sending us a text, 53106, that costs 30 cents, or you can email us, talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we discussed Hitler's plan to build a racial utopia in Norway, travelled from Moscow to Berlin to investigate what happened to the optimism of 1989, and counted the dead of the Irish Revolution, all in our January book show. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com. or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, we're looking at the history of Istanbul. Known over the course of its history by 3 different names, Byzantium, Constantinople, and Istanbul, the city has served as the capital for a number of different empires, including at times the Roman and Ottoman. It's known sometimes it's been known simply as the city, and for many years, as Bethany Hughes, the award-winning historian, has shown, it has not just been a city, but a story. And so in tonight's show, we want to tell the story of one of the world's greatest cities. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Kate Fleet is an economic and social historian of the Ottoman Empire and director of the Skilleter Centre for Ottoman Studies and fellow at Newnham College, the University of Cambridge. And her books include A Social History of Ottoman Istanbul. Dr. Amy Mills teaches at the University of Southern Maine, and her research focuses on urban cultural processes of belonging and exclusion in Istanbul, where she has lived. And her first book was the award-winning Streets of Memory, Landscape, Tolerance and National Identity in Istanbul. Bethany Hughes is an award-winning historian, author and broadcaster, and is a tutor at Cambridge University's Institute of Continuing Education. She's also a research fellow of King's College London and professor of history at the New College of the Humanities. And her books include the best-selling Istanbul, A Tale of Three Cities. Professor Mehmet Ipşurlu is a lecturer in international relations at Istanbul Medipol University and is an expert on Ottoman and Turkish history, and he's worked as editor and article writer on the multi-volume Encyclopedia of Islam project. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll be talking to Dr. Chris Houston, head of the Department of Anthropology at Macquarie University in Sydney in Australia, and his books include Istanbul, City of the Fearless, Urban Activism, Coup d'Etat and Memory in Turkey. Well, as I say, you're all very welcome. And Bethany, I might begin with you and I suppose pose one of these almost impossible to answer questions. Is Istanbul the world's greatest city?
Well, it has indeed been called the greatest city on earth. It's also been called names like the world's desire, the queen of cities, the threshold. And I know we're supposed to be very neutral as historians, but I will stick my neck out. And I think it does deserve a lot of these titles, not just because of its extraordinary wealth of architecture and culture and art, not just because it's arguably one of the oldest founded cities in the whole of Europe. It stretches right the way back. It has this prehistory that I think we'll be talking about tonight, not just because it's incredibly relevant as well politically today, but I think because it's a city that teaches us what it takes to make a city and how, as a species, we can live together across time and across continents. So I think, yeah, you know, I think we should all be interested in Istanbul. And as you say in your introduction, as soon as we're allowed to travel again, we should all go there and celebrate the city.
So precisely because we can't travel there at the moment, how would you describe it for our listeners who, like myself, would love to be able to visit it but haven't been able to?
Oh, you know, well, it's a huge modern metropolis today. It spans about 100 miles. I tell you what I think you need to remember when you think about Istanbul is that a city where water is incredibly important. It was rather beautifully described as a diamond that sits between emeralds and sapphires, and the sapphires, of course, are the Bosphorus and the waters all around. So it's an incredibly dynamic city. It's a city that has kind of brio and verve and vitality. And I think actually the waterways around it really help us remember that it's a city city that people from all points of the compass have come to visit and have settled and have fought over. And although famously it's described as the city that bridges east and west, first of all, it's far more than just a bridge. It's a destination in itself. But as important and really critically important, it's a city that joins north and south. So if you think, if you travel up that incredible wall to the Bosphorus, above it you have the Black Sea, and then beyond that, Russia. If you travel south through the Bosphorus, then down through the Hellespont and across the Mediterranean, the Libyan Sea, you come to Africa. So it's a real centrifugal point for all those different cultures and kinds of interest.
Mehmet, you've lived and worked in Istanbul all your life. I wonder, what does the city mean for you?
Okay. Yes. Actually, I am living in this city for last 60 years. 60. And I came for the university education. Then after that, I became an academic staff in the university, and since then, I am living here. Of course, living in Istanbul, it is a privilege for me, because I am historian, and it has a very rich historical sources, archives, many monumental buildings, and also Byzantine history, Ottoman history. I mean, it is a really an advantage and a privilege for me. Of course, Istanbul, it is a metropolitan city, a very large city. If I just mention some of its characteristics, first of all, it was established on two continents. You know, on the one side is the Europe, and on the other side is the Asian side. And in between, there is a Bosphorus. So I think it is the only city in the world that it was founded on two continents. As myself, I don't know any other city. And Istanbul, it was founded on the hills. You know, usually we just said seven hills. I am talking for the historical peninsula, which was surrounded with the Byzantine wall. So that hilly places, it gives very good view. You know, when you climb it up any hill, then you can see whole city. That's another issue. And then perhaps one of the most important aspects, it was the capital city for about 1,500 years. At first, it was the capital city for the Byzantine Empire. And then, secondly, it was the capital city for the Ottoman Empire. My voice is coming?
No, very good. And Kate, I'm interested in what got you so enthralled, I suppose, by Ottoman Turkey and Ottoman Istanbul, because is it part of that attraction of the city as a whole, that the history itself is also captivating?
Well, I suppose I got into this. I started looking at Middle Eastern history. So when I went to university, I was looking at the Middle East history in general. And I became very interested in the trade connections, particularly between Italy and the Ottoman Empire. And also, when the Ottoman Empire started, before the Ottoman Empire became the Ottoman Empire, it was the Ottoman state was very small, and there were many small Turkish states out, and the Ottoman Empire grew out of that. When I first became interested in the Ottoman Empire, I was very keen on looking at the trade connections between these small Turkish states, including the Ottomans, and one of the main city-states in Italy, Genoa, trading state of Genoa, which was, of course, massively important in the 14th and 15th century. And the Genoese established very close relations, in particular with the Ottomans. So that was my starting point. I think once you've got into Ottoman history, in any period of Ottoman history, then you're hooked and you keep going.
And it's interesting when you look at your work that you can study Ottoman Istanbul and get as it was Constantinople, you can get a good sense of the wider empire. That it's interesting that by studying the city, it actually gives us a good insight and a fresh perspective on what was happening across the empire.
Yes, I think that in a sense, Istanbul was very much the center. I know it obviously the center with the Sultan there, but you had a huge empire. And therefore, there was quite a flexible rule, a lot of local autonomy the further you got away from the center, which in a sense, it's rather like being built in an earthquake zone, but the idea of floating foundations. So the empire was very flexible. For example, in economic terms, you could have local treasuries and a lot of income would be used locally, but even so, accounts would go through to the center. So although it was a huge empire with a lot of local autonomy, Istanbul remained very much the center where the Sultan was, the center where if you were in an outlying island, for example, in the Aegean, you would still want your power networks. They would have to network through Istanbul. And Istanbul would be happy to leave quite a lot of autonomy, but any problems, then the center would move in. So I think that although it's not as if Istanbul had this incredibly tight control over the empire the whole time, it still remained the center of power. And it was to the center, to Istanbul, that people looked. And also it had that prestige of being the center for many things like education or a center of power. So yes, I think looking at Istanbul does give you a mirror onto the empire. At the same time, of course, it's important to remember that the empire being so vast, many areas were very different. You're talking about Cairo or Sofia in Bulgaria, and Istanbul. So it was very diverse, but still with a center, with a core center that held it together.
Amy, you've lived and worked in the city. I wonder, what does it mean for you, and how would you describe the city's unique cultural identity?
There's so much to say about this incredibly rich and beautiful place, and I think our other participants have gestured wonderfully to its many rich histories. One of the aspects of Istanbul that I think is so delightful for anyone who visits is the fascination with the urban landscape and the layers in the landscape. In older parts of the city, the Ottoman and the Byzantine pasts are visible, juxtaposed in the same building sometimes, and certainly on the same block, as buildings built in the 60s and 70s by rural migrants, and then perhaps an apartment that's been gentrified in the last few years. And it's also a city because of its incredible multi-layered historic nature, and because it's so dynamic on the edge of so many land masses and water bodies that have always brought so many people together. The cuisine and the music and the language and the sounds and the sensory aspects of the city are very alluring. When I first visited Istanbul, what truly gripped me, however, was that as I began to experience and learn about the city, it was, in a way, kind of like peeling away an onion, in that each surface contained another story, and behind that, another story. And the more that I tried to figure out truths or solid aspects of the city's history that I could pinpoint, it seemed like I could probe even further for other deeper meanings and for more elusive mysteries. An example would be today in the small village neighborhood of Kuzguncuk on the Bosphorus. There's an open green space that for a while was kind of an abandoned area. Part of it had been used for sort of a parking lot. And by the time I arrived there in the 90s, there was an effort among some people there to protect it as a garden. It used to be a market garden. And I was excited by the civil society movements after the earthquake in August of 1999. And this was one example of people really harnessing a future vision of this particular neighborhood as having a historic green space that could be protected. And as I began to learn more about the green space, I learned that it had been owned by a Greek family and that it had passed through the family for many generations. And the last man, Ilias, who worked on the garden, actually died on the property and was buried at the Greek cemetery right next to it. But the property was confiscated by the state and was held by the state for many years, which is what led to its kind of rundown, derelict aspect through the 70s and 80s. And so I went to the church, the Greek church, to ask them if they were participating in the civil society movement to protect this space. And their attitude was they're not reclaiming the Greek history of this place. They may mention it, but they're really interested in their vision of it being kind of, you know, an elite leftist, environmentalist oriented green area that represents that aspect of the neighborhood. But our aspect of the neighborhood has already been forgotten, and they felt quite some sadness and resentment from that. And then the more I explored, I found the woman who was the last living member of the family that owned the garden. And then I learned stories from people who grew up playing in the garden. And the more I looked, the more I saw these histories actually as very intertwined. Istanbul's multi-ethnic past often comes across as a mosaic of different peoples who kind of co-inhabit a place but maintain some aspect of cultural difference. And on the one hand, that's very true. But I think the real characteristic of Istanbul is its potential for us to see its as the site and the medium for people to share histories, even if they occupy different moments or different positions with regard to the past. And in that sense, it's quite a magical city and quite enveloping, even for someone who visits it for a short time. And for people who live there for a longer time, I think inevitably develop a very strong place attachment to it for its very special richness.
Bethany, a very good quiz question is, what's the capital of Turkey? Because most people would think that it's Istanbul. And I think it's maybe a little surprising for people the way Istanbul was the capital for so many great empires over the centuries, from the Roman Empire for a period, the Ottoman Empire, as we've heard. And yet, for Turkey, they chose Ankara.
Yes, well, that's right. Well, this is obviously after this, as has been described, this kind of rich imperial culture of the city. And then when it became a republic, Ankara became the new capital under Ataturk, of course, refounded the nation as a republic. And the political focus moved to Ankara, although people, I think, would still argue that actually the kind of cultural capital of Turkey really is Istanbul. And it is exactly as has been described. It's one of the things I love about it is that it's such an important city. It has such a place, such a hold over people's imaginations. It's so important economically, politically, socially, in artistic terms, that people have always wanted it to be a city that they claim to have founded. You know, and this goes right the way back to the Greeks. As some of you will know, I'm a big fan of Greek and Hellenic culture. But one thing you see about the Greeks is because they invented the art of history. Historia is, of course, a Greek word. They were very good at writing themselves into it. And the kind of official version of the story of Istanbul is that we hear from Herodotus that it was founded by Greeks in the 7th century BCE. But of course, the archaeology tells us it has a much, much older, deeper past than that. Was inhabited by local Thracians, and before that, right the way back, we're talking 8,000 years ago. These incredible digs in the city because there's a new metro system there, and there's a foundation of the new bridge, the tunnel underneath the Bosphorus, the road and rail bridge. There was a huge amount of digging in the city, which turned up incredible, I mean, spine-tinglingly exciting evidence of its past. And we know that 8,000 years ago, there was a little community there then, and we have, from that time, the oldest wooden canoe paddle in the world that has been discovered, and the oldest wooden coffin. And we know that these women and men were living there, making a very rich life for themselves, rather beautifully eating out of wild cowbone spoons, pistachios. There were pistachio forests all around. So it's a city that's had many different foundations. Somebody once described it as a virgin who's enjoyed many husbands, which is literary description of it. So yes, Ankara is the capital, but Istanbul, in many people's hearts, I think, really is almost still the cultural capital of the place. Just to pick up very, very quickly on what was just being said about the beautiful gardens there, it's also been a city as well that's been full of water, both in terms of the springs and the waters all around and fountains, but also a city that's always had this reputation for being beautifully gardened, of being bedecked with trees and green spaces. the Byzantine emperors used to parade to their beautiful palaces along roads lined with lavender and with vegetables, like a kind of a giant allotment. So it's a city that is very urban, but it's always treasured the beauty of nature and of the natural world.
And Bethany, do you think the fact that it has had so many different foundations and so many different layers, is that why that's such a part of its identity, this multi-ethnic, multi-religious makeup?
I mean, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. If you look at the different communities that have lived there over its 8,000-year history, in fact, it goes right the way back even before kind of humans as we know them, back 800,000 years, a huge number of people have lived there. And I love the fact that the term lingua franca was coined very much with the Ottoman Empire and Istanbul in mind. We talk about lingua franca meaning a common tongue, but that is, of course, a tongue that all kinds of people can understand. So the lingua franca was actually a language which it used some Arabic, it used Western European languages, it used some Ottoman Turkish, and I think in that term, lingua franca, meaning a common language, you have this kind of beautiful understanding of the city as exactly as you say, as a multi-ethnic, multi-faith metropolis.
Okay, well, tonight we are talking history, and we're talking about the history of Istanbul. Elizabeth in Rahini, one of our regular listeners, has texted in on 53106 to say that she's really enjoying the show, and Istanbul is top of her bucket list when we can fly again. She wants to see all of the art and history and also the old buildings. Well, I think I'm with you on that, Elizabeth, and I think it's one of those cities that... Yes, when things change, when things are better, when we can fly again, Istanbul would be there near the top of the list. And in the meantime, we'll bring you there with our imagination. So we'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll continue to explore the rise, fall and rise again of Constantinople and Istanbul.
Talking history, on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. As we go exploring the history of Istanbul, I'm joined by a brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Kate Fleet, Dr. Amy Mills, Bethany Hughes, Professor Mehmet Ipshirli, and later, very soon now, we'll be talking to Dr. Chris Houston at Macquarie University in Australia. Mehmet, can I ask you to describe some of the great landmarks in Istanbul for our listeners? So, for example, the historical peninsula, because that really is one of the really beautiful parts and one of the great historical parts of the city.
Okay. You know, Istanbul had more or less five different parts or districts. And, of course, number one is the historical peninsula, which was surrounded with the Byzantine wall. It's a very large area. And then also there is the Asian side, which is called Üsküdar. And then on the across of Golden Horn, there is a Galata, which during the Ottoman time, most of the diplomatic missions and non-Muslims, they were living there. And one of the most important parts is the Bosphorus, on the both sides of the Bosphorus. So if we look at the mainland, which is the historical peninsula, that was the most historical part of the city. Actually, when Mehmet took over the city in 1453, he started a new program to give a new identity to the city. Of course, it was a capital city of the, as we know, the Byzantine Empire, East Roman Empire, and also it was the center of the Orthodox Church. For about 1,000 years. After the conquest of the city by Mehmet II, there was a new program. That program providing a new identity to the city, giving that it is a Turkish city. It will be a Turkish city, and also it will be center for the Islamic belief. For this reason, the main program here was the Vakıf institution. You know, Mehmet himself, he started to build up his own complex, which we said in Turkish, külliye. And then, of course, the royal family, they similarly built up number of buildings, mosques, schools, and madrasas, etc. So gradually, from Mehmet II onwards, Istanbul had a new identity. Of course, the non-Muslim, which I mean that Greek population and Armenian population, later on also there was a Jewish settlement after the 1492, gradually it has a, such an identity. And main instrument for this identity was the foundation, religious foundation. It is an some sort of NGO. And during Mehmet II time, and then his son Bayezid II, and then Süleyman the Magnificent, they made a very good contribution to the city. And most of the striking establishment, monumental buildings, of course, külliyes, complexes. And for example, in historical peninsula itself, there are about 10 or 12 major complexes. Number one, for example, Mehmet II complex, and then Süleyman the Magnificent complex. Let me just very briefly explain that the complex, because it is an important part of the Ottoman culture and civilization, because they were established a number of buildings. In the center, there was a mosque. And then next to the mosque, there was a mosque courtyard, then garden, and then around the garden, there was a number of educational establishments. We just said medrese, of course, for the higher education. And then also there was a school for the primary children school, which we call Sibyan Mektep. And then in Süleymaniye, there was a very sophisticated, well-established program for the medical school. We just said tıp medresesi, and then Dar Hospital, similarly, and public baths, and number of commercial buildings. So we can actually give a long list. Particularly this public baths, Turkish baths, and commercial buildings. I mean, when I said commercial buildings, it is about 80, 100, 120 shops coming together.
Fascinating, Mehmet. And I might bring in Kate on that as well, because that touches directly on your work as well, because you, by looking at the social history of Ottoman Istanbul, you show that it's a city of pleasure gardens and public baths and mosques. And there are these sharp contrasts, and it's a seat of the Sultan, it's an international centre, but it's also a city of violence. And it's a city that has to withstand a number of natural disasters.
Yes, it was indeed a city that suffered a lot from natural disasters, which of course over the centuries changed the cityscape. One of the big disasters was, of course, earthquakes. Istanbul is in the centre of an earthquake zone, and in fact there was, of course, the major devastating earthquake in 1999. And earthquakes did hit Istanbul very frequently and could be extremely devastating. There was a very, very famous one in 1509, which was called the Little Judgment Day because it was so dramatic. Destroyed many, many buildings. Thousands of people were killed. And according to contemporary accounts, tremors from this earthquake continued for 45 days after the earthquake itself. And the devastation of the walls was so great that Bayezid II, who was ruled at the end of the 15th, beginning of the 16th century, brought in 8,000 soldiers to repair the city walls. So earthquakes certainly didn't do a great deal for the city. Another major devastating factor was, of course, fire. And that was very, very common. You think about the city was built with lots of wooden buildings, very small, narrow streets. And, of course, if there was a wind, then the fire could whip through those wooden buildings at incredible speed and be massively destructive. So, for example, there's a famous fire in the 17th century which destroyed 70,000 houses in 3 days. Peira, which is Galata, or modern Beolu, two-thirds of the area was wiped out in 1870 by a massive fire that also took out the British Embassy, which had in fact already been burnt down once before, a devastating fire in 1831. And the idea that this enormous impact of fire, you can have an idea of it by the fact that in the last quarter of the 19th century, it was calculated that there were 8 fires per month. It wasn't in fact just the fires that caused this devastation, but also the method of firefighting, because one of the ways to deal with fires was to destroy what was in its path to try and prevent it spreading or at least slow it down. So to give an idea of the destruction that could be wrought just by the firefighting itself, in 1804, 200 of 700 houses that were destroyed on one night were actually taken out by the firefighters themselves. The city did suffer a great deal from natural disasters. And there were other, of course, janissary insurrections, violence to do with dearth in the city, protests over lack of food. So in that way, the city did have its violent side.
And Kate, how visible were women in Ottoman Istanbul?
Ha! Women were, it's often thought women were not terribly visible because they were either in the harem, the private quarters of the house, or if they were out and about, they were on their way to the hammam. They certainly were on their way to the public bath. But in fact, women were far more visible in the city than that kind of more traditional view gives the impression of. They could be present, for example, rich women or the mother of the sultan, the Valide Sultan, who was a very important political figure, could be visible in that she could be visiting her son. So she isn't visible in actually, you can't see her, but you see the carriage, you see the procession. The same thing would apply to, for example, marriage processions of the daughters of very high up pashas. These could be massive processions, very colourful, very much of a spectacle. And again, the women, these very rich women, were present by the processions and the carriages. But of course, not all women were rich. A lot of women would be out shopping. Poor women would be shopping for basic provisions, so they would be visible in that way. Or you could have slave women doing the shopping, so rich women could send out their slave women. So in a sense, in the market, women were constantly present buying. Or women peddlers was another major aspect of the city. Women would peddle door to door. And in fact, they were obviously such a common sight that in the 19th century, there are even accounts of men dressing as women in order to smuggle alcohol into their own houses. You also have women as protesters. If you think of the huge city that Istanbul was, one of the big problems was actually providing with sufficient food. So in times of dearth, there were a lot of bread riots, protests. Women were very much visible in these protests, protesting both against lack of food or against the bad quality of bread. That was another common complaint throughout the centuries. And you also got women protesting. They could protest in the 19th century, for example. They could actually be really quite violent in protests. And there was one protest at the beginning of the 19th century where women were very, very angry about lack of food and high prices. They attacked one of the main officials in Istanbul, invaded his house where he was about to have a rather delicious meal. The official fled, and the women marched around lifting off the lids of all the delicious food he was about to consume and banging the lids down and complaining. They then protested by taking poles, marching down the street with little bits of guts and liver on the poles to protest about the lack of food and the pricing, and presented a petition to the Sultan, in fact, complaining about this. So women could be visible. They could also be very vocal. They could also be violent and protesting. And by the beginning of the 20th century, of course, they were also involved in political protest, complaining about the political situation or supporting the constitution or protesting about the position of women.
Okay. Now, just before we went on air, I had the pleasure of talking to Professor Chris Houston, the head of the Department of Anthropology at Macquarie University in Sydney in Australia. Because of the time difference, we had to get him early. And Chris is an expert on the anthropology of the city and the politics and lived experience of Islam. He's conducted extensive fieldwork in Istanbul, where he lived for a number of years, and where he studied the Islamic social movement in Turkey. And his books include Istanbul, City of the Fearless, Urban Activism, Coup d'etat and Memory in Turkey, which was published last year. And given the events that were taking place in Washington, D.C. last week, the eyes of the world were all on the United States, and words like coup d'etat, insurrection were being used in the aftermath of that. Well, I wanted to talk to Chris, first of all, about the 1980 Turkish coup d'etat, which followed after the 1960 coup, the 1971 coup by memorandum. But the 1981 was the one I wanted to focus on. And I asked him to describe the build-up to that coup d'etat and its impact on the citizens of Istanbul.
Yes, so look, the situation in Istanbul before the coup, in the couple of years before the coup, so let's say from 1977 to 1980, was a difficult time for citizens in Istanbul. The reason is that the normal civil society institutions and street life, etc., in Istanbul were becoming very violent. There was quite a lot of political assassinations. In fact, according to some of the figures, in the month before the 1980 military coup, there was 30 people a day being killed in different parts of the city. Sometimes, you know, it was clear who was doing it, and sometimes the assassins, you know, It wasn't clear who they were. So when I did my research with activists and people more recently about those years, they actually said to me that they, if we can't say they welcomed the coup, they actually thought that it was great to put, you know, a sort of a freeze on just what was happening. Of course, they didn't know what was going to happen over the next 3 years. It was interesting, even activists who didn't want a coup said, things were so bad, we thought that maybe, you know, in sort of COVID terms, a total lockdown for a short period would be good. But of course, the shocking reality of what the junta actually did in the next 3 years was really different to what happened. So, yeah, what was it like to live through the coup? And then really the more profound issue is, what was it like to live through 3 years of martial law in Istanbul? That's the sort of the core question. So you can sort of imagine Istanbul in 1980. It's a huge industrial city. There's a military insurrection. Suddenly there's a total curfew. Suddenly flights in and out of the country are suspended. There's a ban on no university attendance, theatre, cultural activities. Everything is shut down. Wanted posters get pasted up at the ferry terminals. Civil police begin watching people, stopping buses. In Istanbul itself, whole suburbs get targeted for special treatment, meaning that the army was going door to door looking for people, dragging out people, etc. There was mass arrests. It became pretty clear, maybe after a couple of months, that there was severe torture going on for the hundreds of thousands of people who were being arrested. So torture and human rights abuses became one of the core features of the next 2 years of living in Istanbul. It was a really terrible time. I think you could sort of imagine, for hundreds of thousands of people in Istanbul, a sort of a fear of arrest, a fear of torture, was a very powerful experience of Istanbul from 1980 to 1983.
And Chris, what about today? What's the relationship between secular institutions and democracy? How limited are things?
Yeah, Patrick, this is a really tricky question. So the 1980 coup, the other reason why it was so influential was that not only did it have 3 years of martial law, but it also established a new constitution. So that constitution, a new Turkish constitution, was put through by the junta under martial law with an election. But, I mean, it wasn't a democratic election. In 1982, and that new constitution came into force. And that constitution right up until 2017 has been the constitution which has been, you know, the framing Turkish politics. And that's a junta constitution. It's a military constitution. It's not a democratic constitution. It's not a liberal constitution. And it has meant that from 1982 or 1980 up until the present, the Turkish military, through the constitution that it put in, which was a very authoritarian constitution, has continued to sort of affect, you know, the politics in Turkey ever since that day. I mean, that constitution, for example, put severe constrictions on union and labor organizing. It puts severe constrictions on the rights of citizens and civil society in a whole lot of different ways. So, yeah, it's a tricky question now about what's the relationship between the Turkish military and the government of today. I mean, that constitution, some of its institutions are still in play. The current government actually did a constitutional amendment in 2017, which they brought to the public through an election. And the ironic thing is that the government did that under a new period of martial law, because after the failed military insurrection in 2017, the AK Party, or the government, declared martial law, and under that state they pushed through a new constitution, which is an amended sort of military constitution, which is hardly any more democratic than the one that we've had in Turkey since 1982. So, yeah, there's a lot of continuity in some ways between politics and Turkey, constitutional politics, for the last 30 or 40 years, regardless of which government actually has been in place.
Chris, you've also done some research on the politics of the built environment and the segregation of space and suburbs in Istanbul. I wonder, could you tell our listeners about that?
Okay, yeah, look, I mean, the politics for the built environment in Istanbul is sort of the most fascinating topic you can imagine. Istanbul, of course, as readers will know, is a city with a 2,000-year-old history. So you can sort of look at the politics of the built environment on a hugely long historical scale, or you can sort of do it more from the last couple of decades, or you can, you know, go back to the beginning of the Turkish Republic in Istanbul and see the incredible recent story of the transformation of Istanbul since 1923, when the Turkish Republic was instituted, and then with the various urban reforms they did then. So, yeah, in my research over the years, I've been studying, for example, some of the things that the Turkish Republic did in the sort of the first radical years when Mustafa Kemal or Atatürk was the president of Turkey, and the way that Istanbul was modernized through various types of modernist urban planning regimes, that we could take that up and, you know, it through to the present. But I've also done research on the sort of the, for example, the ethnic cleansing of Christians and Jews from Istanbul really since the 1930s. That's been sort of a 30-year project, we could say, of the Turkish Republic, as they've Turkified Istanbul. And even more recently, we can think about what the junta did in terms of reorganizing Istanbul after 1980. And then, of course, you know, when the AK Party comes into government around the year 2000, a Muslim-friendly party is an interesting question, how they too begin to intervene in Istanbul's urban environment and begin to, you know, do some forms of sort of Islamic, symbolic Islamic politics through the organisation of space and through the built environment.
And that was Professor Chris Houston, head of the Department of Anthropology at Macquarie University in Sydney in Australia, joining me to talk about Istanbul. And we'll be back after this quick break with more of our continuing exploration of the enduring appeal of this city on two continents. We'll be back right after this.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we explore the history of Istanbul with a brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Kate Fleet, Dr. Amy Mills, Bethany Hughes, Professor Mehmet Ipshirli. And just before the break there, we heard from Dr. Chris Houston from Sydney in Australia. Amy, can I ask you about religious diversity in Istanbul today? How religiously diverse is the city and how important is that diversity to the story of the city?
Oh, this is such an interesting question. I think on one level, we could say, if we think of religion in terms of conventional categories of interest in the city, in terms of talking about Muslims in the city, Jews, and Christians, from that perspective, certainly the city has experienced a great loss of its non-Muslim minority populations. There's more to say about that, but I think it's also important to note, however, that while on the one hand we might describe the population of Istanbul today as predominantly Sunni Muslim, that there has been a really interesting shift in how different people imagine what it means to be Muslim and the relationship between Islam and urban space in the city. And some fellow geographers, Malu Gugurixel and Anna Sikor, have written about post-secularism. And this idea of just different understandings of the place of Islam in the city and different understandings of what it means to be Muslim. So to say that the city is predominantly Muslim, in fact, kind of would gesture towards homogeneity, that in fact is not the case. But more close to my research has been the decline of non-Muslim populations in the city through the 20th century, really. And it's really been, I think, a loss for the city's history. It's important to note that there are still small populations of Jews, Armenians, Greeks, and other non-Muslim minorities living in Istanbul. Many of them are remnants of communities of Central Anatolia or other parts of the western parts of Turkey who left their various cities to congregate in Istanbul. For example, those who attend the Armenian Orthodox churches and keep them open, many of them are actually Arabic speakers from the southeast parts of Turkey or people whose families come from eastern parts of Anatolia. There are Jews in Turkey as well today. And in a way, I think one aspect of the city's religious diversity has been for some of the non-Muslim communities to adopt kind of a strategic display of revealing and concealing identities in public space, in part for concerns for their own comfort and safety, and also as expressions of fellowship amongst fellow co-religionists. For example, it's not uncommon for someone of a Jewish family I know of people, families of other non-Muslim religions who are raised with Turkish names or who themselves aren't aware of the religious diversity in their own family's histories until they themselves become adults, or who are very aware and who speak a minority language like Greek or Armenian or Ladino at home, but whose friends throughout life in public space who are Turkish may never know that their families are Jewish or Greek or Armenian, for example. The religious diversity of Istanbul and its cosmopolitanism throughout history still remains incredibly significant, and I think it's important that it be remembered. In the 1990s, there developed a movement of kind of a collective memory of nostalgia around this cosmopolitanism, which was, I think, an effort to, in a way, recover some of that history before it was completely lost. There has been a very active effort among scholars as well as members of different communities to document their histories in the city, to publish memoirs, to celebrate shared religious cultures, music cultures, for example, and cuisines. And in that sense, I think the religious diversity of the city continues.
Excellent. No, wonderful there. I mean, and Bethany, I might bring you in on a slightly different question. If you had only 24 hours to spend in Istanbul, where would you go?
Well, don't go in a car because you'll get stuck in a traffic jam. Get on a boat and go up the Bosphorus or along the Golden Horn. I mean, there are so many corners of it. As has been said, it really is a layer cake of history. But just stay in the old historical capital. So what looks like, if you look at a map of Istanbul, it's like the kind of rhino horn that reaches out into the sea. And if you wander through there, you'll be wandering through 2.5, sometimes 3,000 years worth of history. Take to the streets, you'll find it's still, obviously, not right now. Tragically, in this pandemic, I know that Istanbul and the whole of Turkey has been very badly hit by lockdown. So you'd just be joined by pigeons at the moment. But just wander through those streets and kind of listen to the ghosts of the past. And as has been described, there's an incredible continuity to this city. So women have always been had a great importance there, going right the way back to the classical period, to this poetess called Moero, to these amazing Byzantine empresses such as Theodora, to Byzantine poetesses such as Cassia. So women are very strong in the city. It's always been a city that has taken to the streets. We're talking about protests. But that's been something which has gone back at least to the 6th century AD. So I would just say kind of walk and listen, but stay in that historic centre.
Excellent. Bethany, do you think it will continue to inspire writers, poets and artists for hundreds of years more, thousands of years more?
I have absolutely no doubt it, and great confidence. It's a city which is kind of a character which is almost bigger than the time it passes through. There's a brilliant quote from the middle of the 16th century from a visitor there who said, though all other cities have their periods of government or are subject to the decays of time, Constantinople alone seems to claim a kind of immortality and will continue to be a city as long as humanity shall live, either to inhabit or to rebuild it. So that's what they were thinking 500 years ago, and I'm sure that's still the case today.
Okay, well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to leave our discussion. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Dr. Kate Fleet, Dr. Amy Mills, Professor Bethany Hughes, Professor Mehmet Ipshirli, and Dr. Chris Houston. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cal, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we're discussing the Battle of Stalingrad, and we'll be debating whether it was the biggest defeat in the history of the German army. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking history on News Talk.